Welcome back. I have been asked by the director that when I finished Kant, when we got through with 1600 and 1800, to give you some brief overview of what happened after it in the 19th and 20th centuries. He didn't ask for the 21st, but we're going to do the 19th and the 20th and give you some idea about what's taken place after Kant. The first thing I need to mention is that the result of the work of Hume and Rousseau joins him in this. Is to pick up on that view of Hume's that says that humans are not rational animals. They are, in fact, emotional animals led by feelings. And what Hume thought he was doing was showing you what happens if you depend on reason. If you depend on reason, you'll end up with my conclusions, is what he's saying. And that's nothing. He thinks his own conclusions are ridiculous. No normal human being is going to believe that all he knows is our colors, taste, such sounds, smells in his mind, inside his mind, and that there's no real world, and he can't know whether he has a self, and he can't know the self-existent being that brought this all into existence, on which everything else depends. And science isn't reliable, and the only ethic you have is to go on feelings of sympathy. Like saying, do unto others as you'd have them do unto me. But he makes that the only rule there is. Well, if you're satisfied with that, you're an idiot, is what Hume is saying. And the real Hume sneaks out every once in a while and tells you what he really thinks. And he says, for example, about the proof of God that depends on seeing the order and the design in the world. Has there ever been anyone so stupid that the world didn't look designed? Then he goes on and argues that's a deceiving appearance anyhow. But he understands what the average person believes what they believe. But what they're missing, what they're being seduced from, is the truth that we run mainly on feelings, not reason. So Hume and Rousseau, and then a great number of poets especially, express this view of human nature, and this movement among artists. This includes painters and musicians, and is called Romanticism. And that's the next big development. In the beginning of the 19th century, Romanticism comes into its own. And they are emphasizing such things as be in the moment, live in the spur of the moment, be spontaneous, don't plan everything. Gardens are now no longer beautifully shaped and maintained. What they want to see is a wild jungle that's been left there just by nature. Is a tree rotted and fallen over? Great, that looks super. That's what we want. They're painting like that. And music takes forms where it definitely assaults our emotions more than our hearing its form and regularity and so on. I mean, really great music does both, of course, but there's an emphasis now that's arising. Everything is played in favor of feeling and passion is valued. And the person that wants to think everything through, like Kant, is ridiculed. Now, you might ask yourself, this may be a movement in philosophy, and it may be in art, and it may be in literature. It certainly is. What about the sciences? What are people in the sciences saying to all this, of Hume trying to save the sciences, and then he doesn't? And I have only one observation. Science goes its own way. And that means it pays no attention. Science stopped paying attention when nobody could explain the mind-body relation. They think that there are rational laws of logic and mathematics by which they can think, reason, construct theories and test them and so on, and they're just going ahead. Do they believe that the world they're experimenting with is nothing but colors, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds? Of course not. They believe they're working with real physical objects that are in real space outside them, a space which they occupy too, a part of. Different part of, but part of. They believe that there are these heavenly bodies that we observe that are way out in space, and they're real physical objects that move in ways that can be predicted once we've got down their orbits and so on. Do the math. It's just going ahead, ignoring this. And one of the results of this is that if philosophy, I'm going to put it this way, science gains in public prestige. And philosophy loses public prestige. You think of the figures that really influenced the 19th century greatly. Two of them are scientists. Only one's a philosopher. The greatest influences in this century are undoubtedly Marx, Darwin, and Freud. As I say, two of them are scientists, only one's a philosopher. Well, I'm going to say a bit about each of them and the influence that they exerted. And that's what I think of as a brief survey. Philosophy in the 19th century begins by attacks on Kant. So not surprising. But nobody yet frees themselves and their thought from the notion that what comes into our minds is only these sensory properties. That's what Locke said way back. And they're still operating as though it's the truth. Instead of seeing that what is given to us are things and events and states of affairs and relations and people, they continue as though what comes into our minds are only sensory properties, not the perception of whole objects that have, among other properties, sensory properties. It's unbelievable. Okay, let's talk about the first philosopher in this period. The first philosopher is going to be Hegel. Now, Hegel, he is somebody, he was born in the 18th century, but he died in 1831. So he lived into this 19th century, and he was a philosopher. And he cooked up a wild theory. He was going to fix up Kant. And he tried to fix up Kant in much the same way that Spinoza had tried to fix up Descartes. He proposed a pantheism. So for Hegel, everything is part of the one great reality, and you can call that great reality mind, or you can call it nature, you can call it God, you can call it anything you want, but there's one great big nature, reality, and everything else is a part of it. So when he likes to call it mind, Geist in German, then he says our mind's part of the great mind. And that great mind is coming to know itself by, in a process of developing creatures so that they have more and more rationality, and that's the God, that's God coming to know himself in humans. We're the highest things in the universe now, but the universe is God. And he came up with a thesis that all reality engages in what he calls dialectical development. So, what does this mean? It means that this Geist, this great mind, mind is all-encompassing. And mind develops in a dialectical way. Dialectical means that something is the case, some set of circumstances, state of affairs, and it provokes its opposite. So this is how things start. This is what gets provoked, antithesis. And that creates a synthesis. Now the synthesis isn't just a combination of the thesis and the antithesis. It's something brand new produced by them and their conflict. That's dialectical development. Now he wants to say that this is true of all reality, and because it is, the logic that we're using, the logic that's come down to us from Aristotle, developed in the Middle Ages, redeveloped further by people like Leibniz, that can't be right, because this is a dynamic development. Reality is dynamic. It's always moving. Everything that is in fact the case is provoking something else to become real, and the conflict together is producing something else, which then becomes the thesis, provoking another antithesis and producing another synthesis. And that's going on constantly everywhere in all respects. So our logic needs to be a logic, a dialectical logic. So everything is, but is becoming something else. And we don't have fixed categories. Logic has to be fuzzier around the edges. So, everything and every belief provokes its opposite, and the conflict produces a new circumstance or belief. The main triad, he says, is being. Now, something just is. It's being, and then the being becomes a particular kind of, it has a nature. And that's the antithesis, and it provokes a further notion, something in the mind. I mean, this is at least weird in my view. If you say there's a being, I would say it already has to be some kind of being. It has to have some characteristics that define it. But he's saying bare being, and doesn't have any nature yet, but it provokes a nature and it becomes something, and then that produces a notion of something else. This is all mental, right? It's all happening in a mind. It's within one great mind, all the smaller minds. Yeah. So, my reaction to that is trying even to deal with it was like trying to nail a custard pie to the wall. For anything you say, well, you think this is so, don't you? Well, yes, but it's right now in the process of becoming something else. So you can't just say it's only that. And he does that with true and false. And now it's really a matter of nailing a custard pie to the wall. How can being and nothing, for example, be the same thing? How can we get a synthesis? How can we figure that anything is both true and false in the same sense at the same time? That's exactly what he does do. He says the law of non-contradiction is not valid. And what do you put in its place? How do you ever know anything if you think that it both is and isn't whatever it is? You know, hand me that skillet, I want to put it on the stove and cook something, and somebody hands me a pot holder. I say, that's not a skillet. Well, it is and it isn't. Cut me a break. The most basic triad of all we've already talked about, but it leads to nothing but confusion. Now, pantheists, and that's what this amounts to, pantheists would think that everything is made of the divine reality. The self-existent reality produces everything else, not by creating ex nihilo, but by creating out of itself. It is the material out of which it makes everything else that is, and it's all contained within it. And they've always had trouble with logic. They've always wanted to say, well, things are and they aren't. You can't just assume that logic is true. And there are people in more recently that have held that same thing as well. But one who held it in the Middle Ages was Nicholas of Cusa. And is someone who has held that in the 20th century, one of my old profs, and a very well-known panentheist. So, what Hegel does is point to paradoxes that can be raised about logic. And he's thinking of Zeno's, for example. And he says this shows that there's a real fault in logic. So let me show you what he's appealing to. Okay. Zeno posed a number of what he called paradoxes. And here's the way it goes. This is George Zelch. And George has a bow and arrow. And George fires the arrow at a target. Now, Zeno argues that sense perception is not the only thing we know. It's precisely what we don't know or what we should ignore. Rational reasoning will show us the truth. Sense perception shows us only lies. And one of the lies is that things change, that there's real motion in the world and change. And here's his first argument. He had about 10 of them. His first argument is, and it goes like this, doesn't the arrow have to go halfway before it goes all the way to the target? Answer, yes, O Zeno, it has to go halfway. Okay, now of the remaining distance, doesn't it have to go halfway of that remaining distance before it gets to the target? And we all say, yes, Zeno, of course. And then he keeps that up, see? So what happens is that the distance between the arrowhead and the target gets ever and ever smaller, but the arrow never reaches the target because there's always half of some distance left. Clever argument. Hegel says that's because our logic thinks in fixed categories that things are either true or false, blah, blah, blah. No, it isn't. It's because Zeno thought that space was really made up of points, right? And in geometry, a point has no dimensions. So how many points are there between one object and another? Well, they're infinite. And nothing is going to traverse an infinite number of points of space in a finite time. That's what Zeno's assuming. If you take space to be a continuum, it's not an infinite number of finite stopping places. It's a continuum. Then there's no problem about seeing how the arrow can hit the target. And anyway, Zeno wouldn't go stand in front of that target on the grounds that it would never reach him. But this is the kind of thing Hegel appealed to back up his claim. Now, why am I mentioning Hegel and talking about something that seems kind of silly? Good question. I'm glad you asked it, because it does seem kind of silly. And the answer is because Marx took it over. And Marx says, dialecticism, this argument about dialectics is right, but it's not dialectics of how minds develop. It's dialectical development of matter. Dialectical materialism. The basic reality, the self-existent reality from which everything else comes, is matter and the innate law of dialectical development. So the what is original, what is uncreated, what is self-existent is matter. And it's innate law of dialectical development. And it's matter that develops this way, not minds. We aren't all little minds that are parts of the great infinite mind. That's Hegel. Nobody's a Hegelian today. But a lot of people still think Marx had a lot right. And the materialist version of this has lasted and exists to this day. Matter develops this way. That's why we get from just a mass, which we could call a plasma or something, we get the development of particles, and then we get the development of subatomic particles, and then we get atoms, and then we get molecules, and we get stars and planets and solar systems. Galaxies. then we get the development of humans. And humans are physical things. They're not minds. They have what we call mind is a collective word for all our reasoning and judgmental powers, but they are all the activities of brains. Brain equals mind. So, on the plus side, I guess you could say, he does at least hold that change and development are real. So are the objects around us. So are people. It goes back to a realism. Everybody else is worrying about just having percepts in their minds and how do we get from that to saying they represent something real. And everybody is concluding they can't. Yeah. Marx doesn't even bother with that. Do we have perceptions? Yeah. Brains perceive things. Can we reason? Yes. But neither of those characterize humans at their core. What characterizes humans at their core is humans alone have as their essential nature that they work. They are the only beings that work for a living. So the rest of this theory is a theory of work. Now, this develops, well, mid to late 19th century. This doesn't sound very romantic, does it? It's anything but romantic. So Marx is a kind of ahead of his time. He's not in step with what's going on in literature, poetry, music, other philosophies. This is a gritty realist who's concerned with real people in real circumstances of poverty, and he wants to say how that came about and how it can be corrected. So you have to at least give him that. Why he's writing this kind of stuff. The poets, I want you to hear some of what they're writing. One moment now means one moment of contemplation and reflection and enjoyment of nature and so on. One moment now may give us more than years of toiling reason. Our mind shall drink at every pore the spirit of the season. And bring no book, for this one day we will give to idleness. It's Wordsworth. Or here's another by him. Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come hear the woodland linnet. How sweet his music on my life. There's more of wisdom in it. One impulse from the vernal wood may teach you more of man, or moral, evil, and of good, than all the sages can. See, you get all that just by contemplating nature. Go out and stare at a tree and you know good from evil. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. He means the leaves of a book. Come forth and bring you with a heart that watches and receives. So drink in nature. That's what everybody needs. Quit studying. You're a student. Don't listen to him. I've got a couple of others. Listen to this. He's talking about children, newly born children. Trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy, but he beholds the light and whence it flows and sees in it his joy. The youth who daily farther from the east must travel still is nature's priest. And by the vision splendid is on his way attended, and at length the man perceives it die away and fade into the light of common day. How do you think that goes over to somebody who's living in a slum and gets told by the local factory owner, you can have this job provided you work here 10 hours, 7 days a week, and you bring your kids to help you and work for nothing? You want the job or no? Yes or no? No, out the door. Next person will take it. That's what grabs Marx's attention. Here's some more of the poet. A presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thought, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and round the ocean and the living air and the blue sky and the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of thought, and rolls through all things. The pantheistic mind, see, the divine rolls through everything. And we sit here and contemplate it. Because we're so rich, we don't have to go to work. Is what Marx would say. Okay, so we're ready to do a little something on Karl Marx and his thesis that humans are beings that work for a living. Got that right. That doesn't mean that that's their essential nature, though, and I'm not going to disagree, not going to agree with that. That's not a Christian view of human nature. Marx determines then that all the rest of the affairs of life is determined, made to be what it is, by our work, by what we do for a living. So there's a dialectical development, and things are always dynamic, and they're always changing, and they're colliding and as thesis, antithesis, and making a new synthesis, and so on. Well, that's right, but it's right about the physical matter, see? And it's right about humans. And he assumed that the thought is dynamic, too. So the logic has to be. He buys into Hegel that it's not clear-cut that something has to be or not be, and can't be both at the same time, or can't be neither, in developing into something else. He's going to, with Hegel, reject traditional logic. And of course, it seems to me that once you do that, then you've opened the gates to say anything you want. And anything you want can be a reason for it. Shouldn't be, but that's the way it works. So what Hegel said about mind, Marx says about body. So there's a real appeal to a philosophical basis for his communism. How do we correct the injustice of poverty? That's what he sets as the main concern of philosophy. How are we going to address that? The rich don't want to talk about it. They don't want you thinking about it. But look what we have here in Europe. Marx is a German who later goes and lives in England. What have we got? Look around. The wealthy have all the wealth. They own the land. They own the means of producing food. They own the means of production. They own the factories and the mines, and they've got all the wealth. And the vast majority of mankind lives in absolute poverty and works for the wealthy. Even if they get paid, they're nothing but wage slaves. Now, Marx's own theory is that this was inevitable. This is a part of the dialectical development of reality, such that we would first get the manorial system. There's the lord of the manor who owns all the land and lives in a castle. And he and his knights grant protection to all the workers, the farmers who produce the food. But in exchange for protection, they owe him a good chunk of any of the money they make and a good chunk of the food they produce. See, that was inevitable. I think there's a reasonably good case that it was. Consider this. We have a landscape, particular landscape, and nobody lives there. And then Farmer A comes, and Farmer A makes a boundary line like this and says, okay, this is going to be my land and I'm going to farm here. And Farmer B comes and says, I'm going to take this chunk, and C takes this one, but D comes and takes this. What determines how much land each farmer claims for himself? And the answer can only be how many sons he has who can work this land with him. How big is his family? How many people are going to go out behind a plow and hold it in the earth while an ox or a donkey or some animal pulls it? That determines how much land you can put under cultivation. And what do you think happens then the first time there's a crop failure? Maybe there's a drought. Maybe it was a locust swarm. Something caused there to be a real failure in the food production, and it's just not there. Of course, they all settle along a stream because everybody had to settle where there was water. You need water for your cattle, you need water for yourself. So it's always along some body of water that these farms come up in history. Well, let's say that there's a crop failure, and C absolutely will not make it through the winter. He won't make it. He can't produce enough food to feed himself and his family. And let's say B won't make it either. And they know it. What do they do? You know, there's no charity around that they can turn to. They're either going to make it on their own or they're going to starve. They're not going to live through the winter. They need to buy food. Where are they going to buy it from, and what are they going to use to pay for it? Well, they only got one thing to pay for it, and that's the land they're on. So what happens is that, let's say, B makes a contract with A. A has enough food because he had a bigger farm to begin with, and he has enough to get by, and maybe he can share enough of it with B's family that B is not, and his family aren't going to die in the winter. So what happens is that B sells off his land to A, and now he works for A. And let's say, similarly, C sells off his land to D. So now This is D's land too, and this is A. So what you get is only two landowners where there used to be four. And we can multiply this, it can happen again. And if it happens enough, the guy that can make it through and share a little bit with the other guy ends up owning the other guy. The other guy's going to work for him. He's going to be the total landowner. And this kind of thing happened everywhere. In Europe, it was called, the landowners were called the nobility, and they had enough wealth that they had a little army, and they could protect the workers on their land, and the workers were serfs. There are all kinds of names from different places. In China, the wealthy landowner is called a mandarin, and everybody works for him there. In India, they were called maharajas. But anyway, what we get is a natural concentration of wealth and land ownership. And everybody else ends up working for the big boss, lives in the great big house on top of the hill, whether that's a castle or it isn't. That's a natural progression, says Marx. We can expect it. And once the middle class arises, up here we have the noble landowners and then we have serfs and peasants. And then what will naturally arise though is a middle class. Now, especially in Europe, and this is where Marx is writing from and writing to Europeans, especially in Europe, the definition of a noble comes to be what it was suggested by Aristotle. Someone who doesn't need to labor with their hands. They may write. They may write music, they may write operas, they may write novels, they might write philosophy. That's okay. They manage their estate with all the serfs and peasants working for them. That's okay. But they don't do physical labor. Aristotle said that physical labor affects your mind so that you can't think as clearly. And that's why the nobles consider themselves the leaders and the serfs and peasants are the followers. After all, didn't Aristotle phrase it even more crudely than that? He said, some of us from the moment of birth are cut out to be leaders, owners, and others slaves. We're just naturally a slave mentality or a leader mentality. And the slaves need the leaders because the leaders can know what to do in any situation. And the leaders need the servants, the slaves, because they can't do it all alone. They need somebody to get out there and do the physical work and put into effect the plan they've made. So one class is planners and the others the workers. And Marx takes that all over. But he thinks it was inevitable that a middle class arise as well. And these are people who engage in trade. So they gather a product in one place, transport it to another, and sell it where it can't be produced. Or they own a mine and they ship the ore somewhere and sell it. They engage in trade. So it soon grows to be the fact that it's not only the nobles that have a lot of money, but so does the middle class have money, and the serfs and the workers do not. They're down here at the bottom. And they alone are left poor, but they're still probably they're the majority. And Marx says, Can't you see that's unjust? What's the matter with all you people? Why do you not care? Being Christian, having Christianity spread through all of Europe and North America and so, doesn't seem to have affected you very much. You don't care that the greatest concentration of wealth is with people who do the least. The next most concentration are people that do work for the living, and they work for what they've got. But they too don't care, or don't seem to, care about the peasants, the serfs, and he's just going to use the term. Workers. How can you tell me that's right? How can you tell me that's morally good to ignore the workers, to leave them in poverty? And what Marx brings forward is a kind of radically new something to bring into public and polite discourse, and that is that the wealthy have passed the laws so that the laws of each country favor the wealthy to get wealthier and the workers to get poorer. And then there's Marx's famous solution. His solution is the workers should become an army and kill all the, he calls it proletariat, I'm going to use a different term, kill all the wealthy. Marx says, of course they're making the laws to protect their wealth. They're taxing the workers and taking money from them when they themselves are so wealthy they don't even need any more. But it's to keep the workers from not knowing their place or something. But there's no solution. They're never going to change, and nobody's ever going to give it up, their wealth, voluntarily to help the poor. It's not going to happen. So the poor need to band together and kill them all and take the wealth. And then the rest of that theory goes like this. Form a classless society. After the workers kill all the wealthy and take their wealth, the wealth, then they must establish a communist society, and that means the wealth belongs to everyone. No single person owns anything, because Marx thinks the cause of all that development in the way it did is the desire for private property. For your information, let me distinguish quickly two things. Socialism and communism. Socialism is the political theory that the government should own the means of production. Now that means the means of producing whatever you need to live. You need food, government should own all the farms. You need health care, the government should own all the hospitals. You need to be able to get to work and travel, then the government owns the railroads, the airlines, and the government produces the cars. there's not no private property. That's not what it's saying. It's saying whatever people need to live, to survive, should be owned by the government and produced at the lowest possible price and sold to everyone at the same price. Can you own a bookshop? A boutique? Of course. A bowling alley? There are all kinds of things that people can own as private property. They own their homes. They own the clothes they put on. They own their car once they buy it. The government's just going to produce the necessities of life and keep them at the lowest possible price for everyone. That's socialism. Communism says the great evil is private property. No one owns anything. The government owns the clothes on your back. The government owns the food that you put on your table. The government owns the house you live. Everything. And the government takes work from you where it knows it's needed within the society over which it is the ruling part, and gives to you what you need to supply to survive. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That's socialism and communism. And Marx's movement begins with his writings and in the writings of Engels, his buddy, who bankrolled him. And they begin to promulgate this as a real counter-gospel to Christianity. And we'll take up this survey. Finish it next session. See you then.